Howdy, SEOpresso listeners. Welcome to another episode of SEOpresso podcast. My name is Björn Darko, and today I'm talking to Rand Fishkin, I think one of the most influential individuals in the SEO and marketing industry. He's the co-founder and CEO of SparkToro. He also co-founded and was the former CEO of Moz, aka SEO Moz, for those SEOs that belong to my generation. And he's also a book author and international keynote speaker. And we will talk today about Rand. So welcome, Rand. Welcome to the show. It's an honor that you be here.
Yeah, my pleasure, Björn. Thank you for having me.
And I was actually checking my bookshelf. I do have three books, by the way, and I didn't actually know that you you've been a co-author of this one, The Art of SEO. I think that's a Bible within the industry. Amazing work. It helped me a lot. And I think most of the things you've written or you co-authored in this book are still relevant today, even though we talk about a lot of, you know, AI and you know, innovations and stuff. Most of the basic things are in here.
Yeah, it's interesting how the industry has changed a lot. I think they're probably, you know, I don't think I would call myself an SEO expert today, but many of the fundamentals remain the same.
Exactly. Then what I also found interesting is inbound marketing and SEO. I don't know if you remember this one.
Sure, like, yeah.
Most of the SEO, most blogs, articles that are pulled out and baked into that book. And then, of course, Lost and Found. And I read it while we had our first call when I was on La Gomera, Canary Islands. And it is, wow, it's a super good book, but more about it later on in our conversation.
All right, sounds good.
I said it in the beginning. It's a huge honor that you are here. I'm a part of the SEO generation that learned a lot about SEO through Whiteboard Fridays, and back then also the blog at Moz, which I don't know, but I think it was the you know, the go-to place when it comes about SEO and case studies and stuff. So it was shared a lot. Looking back, at what growth level, you know, number of visitors or number of viewers, did you know that you had such an influence on a global level?
Global level, gosh. I think probably I started to feel some more significant influence and obligation about that influence around 2009 or 10. So that was, I guess, seven years into the blog being alive and SEO Moz at the time. It was still called SEO Moz just before the changeover to Moz. You know, that sense of, oh, wow, this is really turning into something. But also, gosh, you know, we have a big obligation to this industry to sort of get things right and to amplify the right voices and to support the right kinds of people and organizations and ethics. And that, that was a challenge, especially for, you know, 20-something kid.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I found really interesting, and that's something that, you know, like people want early results, right? But what you wrote in the book, and also my experience with this podcast, I think you wrote in your book that it needed over 1,000 articles before you really saw something moving, right? Before like people really paid attention. And also with this podcast, I think I needed to publish for half a year every week, one episode before I was actually growing. And I think people just want, you know, results like that, and it's actually not happening.
Yeah, not in content, certainly. I think one of the challenges, one of the big problems is that a lot of people see a new source of influence or a new expert or a new social account, new blog, new podcast, new video channel in their field. And because they've never heard of it before and they don't know the history, right? I'm listening to, you know, Björn's interview and I think, gosh, this is so good. He came out of nowhere. And I don't bother to go check out the fact that you've been publishing for 6 months or a year every week doing, you know, doing this work and have a whole career behind you. I just think, well, if he can do it, I can do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that, yeah, that bias, that problem of assuming that everybody came from nowhere, it really misleads you.
Yeah. right, I actually don't want to talk about how you have been building Moss, right? I think we should rather go into more, milestones within the story. But as you also wrote in the book, so you started actually Moss as a consultancy together with your mom, right? And then it turned actually into a software that you needed in order to, you know, have keyword rankings, to, you know, look at numbers that you needed for your consulting. However, you wrote in that book that a software, if you want to build a software like Moss later then, it should be informed by the consulting. What did you mean by that?
Let's see. I think that software that solves a painful enough problem to get traction and get customers usually comes from one of two places. Either you yourself have that painful problem, and so you're solving your own problem and hoping that there are many, many more people like you, and or you have deeply researched a field and are helping people in that field regularly to solve that problem and realizing that there's this hole, a gap that you can't solve with services and existing technology alone. You need something new. You need something better. In Moz's case, we had both, right? We were solving our own problem as consultants, and we had also been helping, you know, dozens or hundreds of companies to do SEO. And so we knew, oh, well, we need to do this thing all the time over and over again, and it's a pain in the butt to do it manually. We need software to do it.
Classic. I think almost every SEO tool that I know has exactly the same story, right? It started out of a consulting, they needed their own data and stuff. And I think Moss at that time was, you know, even the first one ever on the market, right? And then slowly but steady new tools, like in Germany, especially Searchmetrics, Sistrix and whatnot, came into place. And then later you also had crawling softwares and stuff. So you said it needs to be informed by consulting, and I would even go a step further and saying, okay, once you have built your customer base, right, you have the first paying customers and you build something that others also think it's valuable, you should then start, in order to evolve the product, should start to, you know, listen to your customers, look at the jobs to be done, like getting really into product work. Now, there's one story in your book when it comes to Moz Analytics, right, where it was, you and the team, you spent a lot of time, you know, you were building this tool, you were even promoting it before everybody said it's amazing. And then once it was launched, you know, it didn't hit the market, right? Would you say that it's a mistake by founders not to let informed product to build a product, but rather a founder tells product what to do?
Gosh, it really depends on the organizational size and on what the founder's strengths are. You know, some founders are fundamentally product people, product and marketing folks. Some founders are sales folks. Some founders are engineers. Some are operations and financially savvy. So I don't have universal advice there, Bjorn. I wouldn't say, oh, every founder should do exactly this, follow this path. I think this is the frustrating, this is the hard part of starting companies. There's no, oh, well, if you check these boxes, you know, you're going to get straight A's on your test. You know, it doesn't work like college.
Yeah, true. But looking back now, you know, we see like, you know, fast growing, you had like 100% year over year growth rates with the software, right? And then there came a point where it was not growing again. You know, it led to, you know, wrong decisions on the product development part. It also led then to, you had to let people go and stuff. And we, like, reading the book, you can clearly see that it was super, super painful for you. And it must have changed you as a person. So looking back now, how much has Moz changed Rand Fishkin today?
Yeah, I mean, I think that hopefully we're all a product of the things we've learned and the experiences we've had. But certainly I would say that more so than me personally would be the companies that I build. So SparkToro and Snack Bar Studio, my other company, both of those companies are very much informed by the Moz experience. You know, I am trying to build both of them to be lower risk, higher odds of meeting their expectations, making reasonable promises about what they can and can't do, being very cautious about financial spending and, you know, getting out ahead of their revenue. Those are certainly lessons that I carry with me from the Moz days. I also am keeping them really small. SparkToro is only 3 people. Snack Bar Studio is 5. We'll probably grow that team a little bit more because building a video game takes a lot of different talent. But even still, I don't ever want to build a 200-person company again. I don't have any interest in running that type of business, the complexities, the politics, the people management. That's not where I get energy and joy. I like small teams that are manageable with low overhead and communication. So all those things definitely stick with me.
Yeah. I think that's a lesson learned, right? Also on your side, because looking in Germany or Europe or even in the Silicon Valley and the States, like, you know, if you are founding a company and that is not growing like hell and it's, you know, creating a lot of buzz and whatnot, then, you know, people think they are not building something good. They're not building something real. At the end of the day, they are just creating value for their shareholders, right? And that's what you just said, like keeping that small. So you would never, ever go again into venture capital money, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I like raising money. I don't, you know, I'm not sort of wealthy enough to fund my own companies entirely. And so I really like sort of socializing both the reward and the risk and getting help from lots of other people. So I think raising money from investors can be a wonderful thing, but I think venture is a terrible model. It performs very badly on average. The stats of venture-backed companies who fail is much, much higher than companies who never raise money or who take bank loans or who raise only independent style rounds. I don't want those kinds of failure rates. You know, I'm not looking for a 1 in 100 chance to be successful and a 99% chance to fail. I think that that's a weird, silly game that we play in that venture field. And I wouldn't recommend it to others, and I'm certainly not going to do it myself.
What I also found interesting is, like, you know, you had all those insights, right? And it was a very personal note. And, you know, even though I'm most probably like thousands of kilometers apart from you, I have the feeling that I know you a bit because I followed also your career for a long time, you know, because of the influence, because of the conferences I went and you know, the talks that you gave and stuff like that. So I found it a very personal book, but a lot of insights, right? Also from the internal of Moz and from the internal of how it's going on the board and stuff. So how well was that received by the current leadership of Moz that you published that book?
Oh, yeah. Oh, they were definitely not happy about the book. Yeah, of course. Oh, man. No, Bjorn, they hated it. In fact, so, well, you know what? It's hard to say, because here's what happened. As I was writing the book, the leadership team sort of and the board demanded that they get a copy. They wanted a copy of the book before it was released. And of course, my publisher, Penguin, said, absolutely not. That's not how anything, you know, Donald Trump didn't get a copy of his, you know, biography before it was published. We're certainly not going to give it to you, little, you know, this little startup company. And the reality was that they were very, very concerned about what would be in the book, what it would say about them. I think hopefully if you read the book, you would come away with the sense that I am not trying to throw anyone under the bus except myself. right? Yeah. All the criticism that I have for all the mistakes that Moz made rests solely on my shoulders. I'm the one who, you know, made the choices about how much to raise and when and how to spend that money. I'm the person who chose to step down as CEO. I chose my replacement. So anything that, you know, the leadership team did after I was gone, that's also my fault, right? Because I'm the person who chose them. I chose those board members. Yeah, there's no one to blame here except.
In der Welt von SEO, einem Meer voller Agenturen, sticht eine besonders hervor, nämlich Digital Effects aus Berlin. Anders als viele setzen sie nämlich auf authentisches und nachhaltiges SEO, das wirklich Resultate bringt. Gegründet im Jahr 2010 von Andreas Mauf und Christian B. Schmidt oder in der Branche auch bekannt als CBS, hat sich Digital Effects darauf spezialisiert, ausschließlich Dienstleistungen im SEO anzubieten. Sie haben bereits eine beeindruckende Erfolgsgeschichte, indem sie diverse Unternehmen, Online-Shops und Portale im Finanz- und Reisebereich auf Plattformen wie Google, YouTube und neu auch Amazon erfolgreich organisch skaliert haben. Und das Besondere an Digital Effects, ihr Team. Jeder Berater verfügt über mindestens 5 Jahre Erfahrung in der SEO-Branche und Christian B. Schmidt, CBS, ein Pionier im Bereich SEO, optimiert Webseiten seit 1998, dem Gründungsjahr von Google. Ich selbst kenne und schätze Christian für seine tiefgehende Expertise und bin stolz darauf, ihn mehrfach im SEOpresso-Podcast zu Gast gehabt zu haben. Und jetzt kommt das Beste. Digital Effects bietet euch SEOpresso-Hörerinnen die Chance, ihre Expertise hautnah zu erleben und das völlig kostenlos. Interessiert? Besuch jetzt digitaleffects.de/SEOpresso für einen gratis SEO-Audit. Nutzt diese einmalige Gelegenheit, um mehr Traffic ohne zusätzliche Kosten pro Klick zu generieren. Also noch einmal, das ist digitaleffects.de/SEOpresso. Mehr Erfolg im Web, weniger Kosten, echte Resultate. Mit Digital Effects bringt ihr euer SEO auf das nächste Level.
I remember that posting, if I'm not mistaken, I remember the posting, was it on LinkedIn or Twitter, where you had a box in your hand in front of the boss sign, and you know, the posting went like this, that you will leave Moz as a CEO and stuff. How like, was it well prepared before, or like how hard was this day for somebody that founded such a company that was responsible for so many people and also the life of so many people? Can you take us a bit on this emotional travel in that day?
Yeah, I mean, I think going back and revisiting that blog post is probably the best way to get into that headspace. I think it was called My Last Day at Moz, My First Day at SparkToro. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was very emotional. It was very hard. I knew for several months that February 28th, 2018 would be my last day at the company. But, you know, it felt awful for all the time leading up to it. It felt awful that day. The next day was great, though. The next day was really wonderful because thousands, probably tens of thousands of people, from all over the world left comments and sent tweets, because Twitter was still a thing at the time, you know, put up LinkedIn posts, sent me emails. My inbox was so full that it took me probably 2 weeks to get to answer all the messages. And I'm very fast at email. There's just so much kindness and so many wonderful stories of things that, you know, I had done or Moz had done for people in their professional and personal lives. And it made me reconsider what I thought about the job that I had done there and what was really important. You know, my suspicion is that a lot of founders leave their companies with a lot more money than I left Moz with, but they probably don't have that kind of positive impact on that many people. And that feels like a better trade, right?
You know, I guess so. Yes.
Yeah, I think that's a more worthwhile couple of decades spent at a company to help so many people build careers, have success, get jobs, get an education, take on a field that was previously mysterious and difficult for them. That's very meaningful.
Now, you also, like, I don't know if you already had the term back then, because, like, looking back, like, you know, Whiteboard Fridays, and, you know, we were waiting for Friday, because every Friday there was a new video being published. So it was kind of a thing, right? And so you did this, you did the blog and all the contributors to the blog as well. And I mean, at the end of the day, that's what we call today content marketing, right? So you build content, topical content, you know, acquired users around the software product, and then actually put them down the funnel to eventually also buy the software or a subscription to the software. Back then, did you already like had that tactic in mind, or was it just like, you know, by accident, so to speak, that you created this content marketing approach?
I would say the very early years were by accident, you know, 2002, 3, 4, 5, those years, totally by accident, didn't really realize what we were doing. I just enjoyed publishing content. I liked helping people learn to do better marketing. I liked helping people do SEO. I was frustrated, very frustrated with, you know, Google and Microsoft and Yahoo, that they didn't publish any content about how to make their systems work, because I thought that was fundamentally unfair and not right. I thought security through obscurity was a foolish explanation for why they didn't publish that. I thought there would be less spam if they wrote about it rather than more spam. And so, I was very passionate about producing that content, but I didn't know whether it would have business impact. And then, you know, starting in 2005 with the Beginner's Guide to SEO, that was published at the end of 2005. That started getting us, you know, so much traffic, so many people reaching out and asking us to do consulting for them. We had to start turning away business for the first time ever. That was exciting. And I sort of realized the impact that at least blog marketing could have. And as social networks rose up, right, Facebook and Twitter, LinkedIn had been around, but it wasn't really a social network at that point, that those became sources for that as well. And eventually Whiteboard Friday too. But Whiteboard Friday was after we sort of realized that content marketing was a real thing that we could invest in. And I want to say, you know, when Joe Polizzi sort of named content marketing and called it out, Moz was one of the examples that he used of like, hey, here's a company that's doing content to earn their traffic, which turn into their customers and help them retain customers and build a market share.
Yeah. But for me, that was always content marketing. That's what Moz, for example, did. So it was always a role model in how to create content around the product and then, convert them into customers. So you've been also like a public figure since then, I would say. You spoke at most probably hundreds, if not thousands, of conferences around the world. You also published books and stuff. So I can imagine, because I just did it on a very small scale, public speaking, but it's quite intense. So you have to, like, it's a lot of effort for, you know, at the end of the day, just a bit of fame or, you know, just a bit more. Markus Tandler put it this way. He spent like 2 weeks to creating a presentation. At the end, he just had 100 more followers. So it's not worth the effort. However, you did it and you're still doing it. But I think it must have been quite stressful also being a CEO, also with that circumstances that you had. Like, tell me a bit about like the journey of being a public figure and how much it has changed you as well.
Okay. Well, first off, I like Markus a lot. Obviously, you know, we've known each other a long time, but I think I disagree with him on this one. I don't think number of new followers or traffic or anything like that is the way to measure the value of public speaking. For me, the value of public speaking comes from the resonance and engagement level that you receive from an audience in real life versus what you could get on a webinar or on LinkedIn or Threads or via podcast. You know, this is no, I don't mean this in any way other than the reality of it. But if you are listening to this podcast right now, you might say to yourself, oh, this Rand guy sounds interesting. I haven't heard much about him before. I wonder what's going on with Spark Toro and Snack Bar Studio. Maybe I'll go sign up. You know, I like video games. I'm going to go sign up for the Snack Bar video game email list or whatever it is. Some people might do that. That's possible. But if we were in person, if we were having this conversation on a stage, if I were presenting this story, you know, with slides and lights in a fancy auditorium and people are there and you can come up and we can fist bump afterward and have a little chat, the resonance, the engagement, the memory is different. It is not 100-fold, it's 1,000-fold different than listening to someone online or reading a blog post from them. And so what you are essentially trading when you go to an in-person event as a speaker or an attendee, right, is you are trading reach for resonance. And I would argue that, you know, 100 people in an auditorium is worth 100,000 people seeing a tweet of mine. And that's the difference, right? So Marcus might say, hey, I only got these 100 followers. And I would say, yeah, but you got 1,000 times the engagement with those 100 people.
Yeah, absolutely. But I remember, I think the first talk that I saw from you was Linkloff in London. Could that be? Is that possible?
Like, yeah, I certainly did those events. It was only a few years that they ran those, that Distilled ran those, yeah.
Yeah, and then it converted into Searchloff, so it was the only, one of the best conferences in Europe. Very small, hand-picked speakers and topics. It was really cool.
Yeah, Searchloff was amazing. So they started Searchloff, I believe, in London. It came out of, you know, Moz and Distilled had done these events together for a long time. A long time. I think we started doing events together maybe in 2006 or 2007. Will Critchlow and I, Duncan Morris, the founders of Distilled, and I were friends, and we ran these. I think we called them the SEO training seminar. We ran one in London together. We ran one in Seattle, and then Moz essentially was becoming larger, and I couldn't, you know, I didn't want to build a huge events business. We ended up building MozCon, which was just one event in Seattle, a very large event every year. But Distilled kind of took this event training seminar brand and brought it to several cities. You know, they were in New Orleans, Boston, New York, San Diego almost every year, London, of course. And Searchloff took off as a brand and it stayed small. It was always 250 to maybe 400 attendees. But they had absolutely the best events in the field. You know, I spoke at tons and tons of search conferences throughout my 17, 18 years at Moz. And Björn, I agree with you. I think that one was the best because they kept it small and exclusive. They handpicked the speakers. They worked with every speaker. You know, Will would have a conversation with me, a call for every slide deck that I presented there. We'd walk through it together. He made sure it was just spot on. And then the engagement, that resonance, right? You got to meet all the people there. There was a dinner the night before. There'd be a party the night after. Those are great events. I'm sad to see they're gone. But I believe, I want to say that Brighton SEO actually picked up the old Searchloff brand. And they are now coming to San Diego, where Searchloff used to be every year for the first time this year. And I'm going to be giving the keynote there.
Ah, amazing. Brighton goes San Diego. That's funny. Let me put this question like this. Like, what is your secret sauce, right? Running a business, a successful business, like also with those circumstances, but then still being able to travel around the world and doing so many conference talks. I mean, just looking at it, it must be like humanly impossible to have so much energy and ending up in a burnout. So what's your secret sauce on this one?
Well, first off, I'm going to say that at Moz, I did end up in burnout. Yeah. Absolutely. I burned out, in a pretty painful and spectacular fashion. With SparkToro, though, you know, we have this thing that we call chill work. So we try and do 30 hours or less of work each week, the three of us who work here. We are not attempting to build the company to be growth at all costs. SparkToro is nicely profitable. We put away a bunch of money every month. We plan to, you know, pay our investors dividends rather than trying to sell the company. So we don't really have to worry about external metrics, right? We're not building it to sell. We're not building it to fundraise. We focus on a few things that we think make a big difference and ignore everything else, right? We don't, you know, we get lots of questions about like, hey, can you do affiliate? Can you, you know, come to these other language regions? Can you support these other kinds of payments? Could you, you know, do enterprise? And we just say no to all of it, right? And we focus on the few things that we're really good at and that we know we can do well. The other secret, full disclosure, I don't have kids. I think this is the big thing that for a ton of parents, you know, I talk to a ton of moms and dads, other speakers, and they, you know, it's much more intense for them. Mm. Like they, that time away from home, that time away from kids, that's way harder. Geraldine and I don't have kids. We often travel together. So for a lot of the events that I do, Geraldine joins me, not always, but you know, maybe half the time or more. And so we can turn it into a little mini vacation on the weekend too.
Yeah, I know. And I think you're a big fan of Italy, right? Or at least like pasta or like the recipe or food from Italy.
Both. The snack bar, the video game is all about cooking food in Italy.
You see, I remember that quite well from, I don't know, what was it on Instagram? I can't remember, but yeah, I figured that you have a big passion also for Italy. If you look like the difference between the US and Europe, what is like pro Europe versus con US and vice versa?
Gosh, I mean, I think that there's a lot of lovely things about, well, Europe is a big place. There are a lot of different countries and a lot of different cultures. I mean, Germany is very different from Norway, which is very different from France, which is very different from Italy and Spain and Portugal. So, you know, I don't want to generalize, but I would say, broadly speaking, one of the things that many European countries do very well is the social safety net. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, you get far less wealth disparity and much greater sort of sharing in the portions of GDP that are there to go around. And that makes a big difference, right? In a lot of ways. I think the United States has a very brutalist capitalist economy and by and large, tragically, a ton of people fall through the cracks. You know, we have much, much worse sort of the bottom 20-30% of American citizenry by economic measures is in a really, really tough place. And this is far less true in Europe. And by that standard, I think almost everyone in the United States or elsewhere should prefer the European system. What I think the United States does quite well is well, historically, there are plenty of challenges now, but historically, it's been a country of immigration. And immigration is fantastic. I think Germany actually is doing, you know, obviously having its challenges with immigration, but I'm sure you can recognize like there are amazing things that come from immigration, innovation, creativity, entrepreneurship, growth mindsets, people who would never have met, you know, 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago, being able to exchange ideas, being able to meet for coffee, becoming friends, falling in love, building relationships and families. That is one of the things that that's beautiful about the United States. You know, I think that multiculturalism, when it's embraced, and obviously the U.S. has a lot of pushback against that nowadays from certain sort of cultural and political sectors. But that can be absolutely extraordinary. And I think it's almost certainly responsible for the entrepreneurial culture that we have here.
Absolutely.
So when you see people you know, they hear about the promise of the United States, especially for the previous 200 years. And the promise of the United States was you can go there. And if you are willing to sort of start your own thing, be creative, be thoughtful, have great ideas, execute on those ideas, work hard to see them through, the United States is a place that enables that. A friend of mine runs a company in Italy. His name's Paldi. Bjorn, I don't know if you know Balsamic, the wireframing tool.
Yes, I know.
Product wireframing tool. Yeah. So Paldi runs this company. It's based in Bologna, Italy. It's a pretty small team. I think it's 25 or 30 people, but quite profitable, you know, similar to SparkToro in that respect. And Paldi often likes to say, Italy is an incredibly difficult place to start a business. Mm-hmm. There's so much government regulation, rules, the city, the county, the country. It's just incredibly hard to start a company. But because it's so hard to start a company, there's almost no competition if you do. He points out, right? Like I'll say to him, gosh, I can't believe this business has been going for 70 years. And he's like, well, nobody competes with them.
Yeah.
They're the only ones who do it, yeah. Right? It's really tough to start a new business. And as a result, the old businesses keep going. And I think there's also there's a love for old things in Italy, right? There's a respect and a value that's put on. Have you been around for 50, 100, 200, 500 years? Then you must be good.
Yeah.
You started last week? You're probably not very good. Well, and that's very different from the United States, which is always looking for the new thing.
What I really like about being a European, like I can just jump on a plane and within an hour, I will be in a completely different culture, country, language, food, like the buildings look different. And I think that's not what you have in the US, right? So you always like find kind of the American influence, you know. Most probably you will speak Spanish or hear Spanish, but most of the time you just speak your own language. And this variety is, for me, makes Europe really a great place. Even though I have to, you know, agree with you, also Germany, like all these obstacles that the government gives you because you have to fill out this report, you have to take this data, you know, assurance, you have to sign this. And, you know, it's a long way, but once you've done it, you know, you did it, and then you can almost create everything that you want. That's really cool.
Yeah. So, you know, these differences are not purely cosmetic, but I think we can agree, right? When you reduce barriers to entry, I think that's a wonderful thing. You know, I would argue, I think that I wish the United States acted more like Europe towards its big businesses. Mm-hmm. It's big companies and it's wealthy people. And I think that Europe might consider acting more like the United States toward new things, right? New companies. Well, immigration is tough now, but you know, historically, I think that there's wonderful opportunity to build incredible things in Europe, but that friction of getting started and running a new business of, you know, if you have a company of five people even, and you want to fire one of them in Europe, it's tough,
expensive.
Right? Like, extremely expensive, extremely difficult, hard to do. Sometimes you can't do it at all.
Yeah.
In the United States, you know, it's at will employment, which has its downsides, but especially for small businesses, I think that, it's fair. It's very fair to say like, hey, you don't know it when you hire somebody, if they're going to work out. Yeah. Maybe let's reduce the risk of a small business bringing someone aboard.
Completely different topic now. What does love mean to Ren Fishkin?
Oh, man. My gosh. I mean, obviously, there's plenty of different kinds. But for me, I feel a lot of love toward a tremendous number of people, probably more than almost anyone I know. And that's friends, it's people in my professional life. You know, obviously, my wife, Geraldine. But I think that at its base, that the core of that is a feeling of connection, of shared humanity, of desire to help people do better, to want to see them succeed in their life, whatever that means for them, and to genuinely care about the person with no thought for any kind of return. Mm. Right? It's not it is not a reciprocal relationship. The beauty of love is that it's a giving relationship, and the only competition is who can give more. I think that
it's a very nice way to put it. Like, how much, like, you know, Geraldine, your wife, like, how much contribution did she had to, like, the rent that we know today?
I mean, there's Bjorn, we met when we were 19 and 20. We started dating when we were 21 and 22. So we've been together basically our whole adult lives. Mm-hmm. And I think have had a massive influence on who the other person turned into. We're not inseparable, but we are kind of a package deal. There's no Rand without Geraldine. This, you know, I don't think that this person, that I would be anything like what I am, if I hadn't met her, or if I had met someone else, or those kinds of things. I will say I was definitely the kind of kid who always wanted to fall in love. Right. That was something that was very appealing to me.
Yeah. I know what you mean exactly, because you know, back, like, if you're 13, 14, 15 or so, you heard about the term love, and then you have your girlfriend, and kind of, you know, most probably didn't feel much, but you thought, okay, is that love now? Is that love now? And once you really experience love, boom, it is, wow. It is, I think it's one of the, like, being in love or having a crush on somebody for the, especially for the first, I would say 1 year, right, is like one of the best feelings in the world.
It is, but it's also, gosh, I think that early kind of love is so overwhelming and needy and vulnerable.
Yeah.
You know, it sort of exposes you to pain and hurt and things going wrong. And I far prefer the sort of, you know, slow simmering, long-term, stable love that I have today. It doesn't feel as risky. I love the security of it. I also think love is not just a feeling. In my opinion, most of what love is a choice. Yep. It is an action that you take day in and day out to do things and not do things that show your love, that engage in the activity, right? It's not that dissimilar from sort of building a company. Like, every day you get up and you do things that build the company. It's a choice. It's a decision. You put in the work. And love is the same way. It's, you know, recognizing, you know, whatever. Geraldine left the cereal out this morning, and I only have 30 seconds before my podcast starts with Bjorn, but I'm going to roll up the cereal box because I know the cereal goes stale and she will like it. She won't like it tomorrow. So I'm just going to put it away real fast and I'll be 1 minute late to the call with him. Yeah. And that's what I did, right? Because it's just a nice thing to do. And it's those little things, right? It's those actions every day, all the time. That's sort of what love is, rather than that puppy dog feeling of desperate need that you have in year one, year two. Yeah.
I will ask you this, and please, if you don't want to answer this question, fine. I can cut it out, right? But in the book, the foreword is: to my grandparents, Pauline and Seymour, my mom, Jillian, and my wife, Geraldine, your love and support were my first investors. I'm missing your father. And even like in the book, like he, it was like he was described twice, I think, but not really in a good way, I would say. So like maybe you want to elaborate a bit on like because also this has a big influence. I have the same story, right? But like why did you leave out your father so often in that story?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not someone who's good at covering up the truth or trying to hide what's really going on. Yeah. And I think if you read the book, especially those first few chapters, right, you can very clearly see that my mom and I and my brother and sister and I, like, we were all very afraid of my dad. Always worried that he'd sort of fly off the handle and that he would make life difficult for everyone. He could be very controlling about things. You know, I think he was sort of quite a good dad when I was a little kid, because he could be very loving and caring. He really liked, I think, having little kids, but then did not like older children who were trying to declare their independence or have their own thoughts and feelings. He was very conservative in this way, right? He really liked people to be dependent on him and to do the things that he wanted them to do, to act the way that he wanted them to act. And so, yeah, you know, I think it would have been disingenuous to thank him for his support of my professional career and Moz and all the things that I talk about in the book, because he was very unsupportive of those things. Like every time we interacted in the first 10 years of the company, the only thing he wanted to know was when I was going to quit this silly company and get a real job. Right.
Wow.
And
even though you partnered with your mom and at company.
Yeah. I think he was upset with both of us, for doing this. Right. And my parents, you know, were married. My father unfortunately passed away about a month ago.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Sorry that I brought this up. Oh God.
No, that's okay. That's, I talk about this stuff openly. He was just a very challenging guy, you know, really hard to get along with and not, you know, I don't think he was particularly proud of me or my mom or what we achieved. I think he was, you know, obviously my mom sold her stock and made a nice, you know, a very nice retirement for him and her. And I think he was grateful for that, but also maybe a little bit resentful that it had come from a source that he didn't support. So it was complicated. We didn't have much of a relationship kind of the last 10 years of his life. But I am, you know, I'm very close still with my grandfather, who is amazingly still alive, 96 years old.
Wow.
I'm going to have dinner with him tonight.
Oh, nice. Send greetings.
He's doing great.
To him.
Yeah, I'll let him know. We're going. I mean, Bjorn, he's amazing. He's 96. He was, he signed up for the American Armed Services in World War II. He didn't actually get deployed, but he's lived this incredible life, absolutely incredible life. Became a chemical engineer for many years and moved out to Seattle. And tonight we're going to a bar that's run by a friend of mine. And then we're going to go out to dinner and get some pizza afterward. And, you know, he's just, he can do it all. It's pretty incredible.
Wow. Rand, if you can now travel back, right? Or like you can travel into the future. So let's say 20-year-old Rand, right, travels into 2024, knows that he, you know, is creating this business and, you know, maybe doesn't really know how to do it and more or less does it step by step. But 20-year-old Rand has the chance to travel into the future, meet 2024 Rand. What do you think would 20-year-old Rand ask today for an advice?
My goodness. Gosh. You know, I bet one of the things that he would probably ask is, hey, so what's going on with that Geraldine girl? Does that work out?
Yeah. But what
I'm sure, that would be among the first questions.
What would you warn him? Like, is there any warning that you would give to him? Don't do that, or don't go in that direction.
Yeah. No. I mean, I think that I would say it's going to work out great. It's going to work out just fine, and you don't need to worry about it. As long as you be the best guy that you can, you're going to be okay.
Right.
And that relationship's going to be okay. I think on the business front, the one thing I have obviously lots of regrets, but also a tremendous amount of learning from those regrets. And so it's really tough to want to, I don't know, rip up the past and change that. Like, I'll tell you one of my big fears, Björn. Mm-hmm. One of my big fears is, what if in 2011? Yeah, 2011. I had taken the HubSpot deal, right? It was for, it would have made maybe, let's say, somewhere between $30 and $40 million, you know, we would have sold the business for, but a lot of it would have been in stock. And that stock would have probably been worth 10 to 30 times as much. So, you know, potentially thinking about like, all right, let's say that $10 million of it was stock in HubSpot. Maybe that would have turned into, I don't know, $100 million at IPO.
Wow.
Would I be one of these business tech bros today who's like, you know, here's how to raise venture, here's how to sell your company, here's how to become rich like me, you know, flying, I don't know, probably not private jets, but, you know, flying first class all the time and, I don't know, being generally an intolerable dick. Like, I really worry that I might have turned into that person. I don't meet a lot of people who become very rich at 30 years old and they're amazing people. That it's rare. I'm not saying it's impossible. Hmm. There are plenty of examples of cool people, but I think there's also, you know, you have to convince yourself, if that happens to you, you have to convince yourself that you weren't lucky. Hmm. And you were lucky. But many of them convince themselves that they were so smart, they were so good, they worked so hard. And if you just do the things that they did, you can be like them. And it's really not true. It is completely not true. I mean, the fact that even that I had the opportunities that I had, and that, you know, we have the sort of lifestyle and finances and wealth and, you know, these companies, this wonderful existence that we have, that so much of that is luck. It was not earned. Yes, some decisions were good. Yes, I did hard work, but I have never worked a day in my life as hard as most janitorial staff works every day. Mm. Never. I have never put in hours like that. And they're never going to get rewarded the way, you know, I was rewarded. So I just, yeah, that's one of my big fears.
Yeah, and I think the younger you are, the worse it is, right? So if you make that fortune like in your 20s or so, of course it turns you into a dick because you're completely disconnected to the normal world, right?
Yeah. I remember meeting some, some folks in Seattle who sort of hit it big in their early and mid 20s through varieties of things. And they weren't terrible people, but my suspicion is that they would have turned into really awesome people if that early financial success had not hit them. It does. It disconnects you from reality and it makes you unempathetic. I think it's so tough to stay humble and grounded after millions, tens of millions of dollars, especially, enter your bank account.
Yeah. Rand, we have to make a cut here. My kids are waiting for me to bring them to bed. And
I know. I have to jump on a call. I'm going to tell you a secret, Björn. Yeah. I don't know if you can share this, yes, with anyone, but the secret is I am about to jump on a call with my book agent because I'm going to talk to her about writing another book.
Oh, amazing. What's about?
Yeah, I cannot say. I cannot say yet, but once I have some conversations, once it goes to a publisher and all that, there should, you know, we'll figure it out, but
amazing.
Exciting calls, and you've got obligations, so please go hang out with your kids. thank you so much for having me. This was really enjoyable.
I hope it was not, you know, too uncomfortable to ask personal questions, but thanks for your openness. Really enjoyed it, and hopefully we'll see it in person at, you know, one of the conferences that we share.
I look forward to it. Can't wait.
Amazing.
Take care of yourself.
Thank you. Ciao, ciao.
Bye. Bye-bye.